Radio. I'm Lisa Brady. The man suspected of shooting two law enforcement officers earlier today in Arkansas is now in custody. Fox Radio's Tanya J. Powers has this live.
Well, that suspected shooter, Billy Jones, had barricaded himself in a home during the standoff. The shooting happened this morning in Sebastian County in western Arkansas.
We've had a deputy that was shot, as well as a Hackett officer that was also wounded.
That's Sheriff Bill Hollenbeck. He says Hackett Police Chief Darrell Spells is expected to be okay. Fox 16 in Little Rock reports Sebastian County Deputy Bill Cooper is in critical condition. Lisa.
Thanks, Tanya. Baltimore's police chief vowing that bias will not be tolerated as the city responds to a new Justice Department report. Fox Radio's Rachel Sutherland, live in D.C.
Lisa, the Justice Department says the Baltimore Police Department routinely violates people's civil rights and uses excessive force. Civil Rights Division Chief Vanita Gupta says investigators also discovered a pattern of police targeting African Americans.
These violations have deeply eroded the mutual trust between BPD and the community it serves.
Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake says the city has already started making reforms to the police department, including rolling out body cameras to all officers. Lisa.
Thanks, Rachel. A sudden loss at ESPN.
Our generous and talented and beloved colleague John Saunders has died.
Hannah Storm making the announcement on SportsCenter in Rio. There's been no word on a cause of death. Saunders joined ESPN nearly 30 years ago. He was 61. Delta travelers facing a third day of cancellations and delays as the airline tries to get its computer systems back up to speed after a Monday outage at its hub in Atlanta. More than 150 flights canceled today, hundreds more delayed. Delta says it expects to resume normal operations sometime today. The Dow right now down 35 points. Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
Real experience, real insight.
We're following this explosive story.
Nothing gets by Greta. Then.
This is all BS. What was that all about?
There's no spin and no question. O'Reilly dominates. Plus, smart, sharp, and cutting edge.
It's the news of the day, but with a little heat.
Megan delivers. And Sean seals the deal with fearless talk.
What part of that are you understanding?
Most watched. Most trusted. Fox News Channel.
There's more to Fox News Radio than meets the ear. Go behind the headlines and join the conversation on the hottest stories of the day on the Fox News Radio Facebook page. Be a part of the Fox News Radio Facebook fan community. Post comments and tell us your opinions. See behind-the-scenes photos and videos and post your reactions to the stories that matter to you. Click the like button on Facebook and connect with breaking news and features like Fox in the Fast Lane, House Call for Help, and more. Go to Facebook.com/Fox News Radio.
What had been ISIS headquarters in Libya is now in the hands of Libyan militias backed by U.S. airstrikes. They launched an offensive against ISIS in June, now seizing control of the group's headquarters in Sirte. The Pentagon says no U.S. troops are on the ground in Sirte. 2 years since the first U.S. airstrikes against ISIS, there's a new estimate of 45,000 enemy fighters killed.
There's no question that our strikes have enabled the liberation of more than 25,000 total square kilometers from Daesh.
Army Lieutenant General Sean McFarland says that's nearly half the territory once controlled by ISIS in Iraq and 20% in Syria. The death penalty still on the table for the so-called Grim Sleeper serial killer. A judge about to sentence him rejecting a defense motion to set the death penalty aside as unconstitutional in California. A jury recommended execution for Lonnie Franklin Jr., convicted of killing 9 women and 1 teenage girl over more than 2 decades. The defense is seeking a new trial. A Mississippi mother is asking prosecutors to drop the charges against the father of her daughter, who died after being left in a hot car.
Shanice Carradine says what happened to her daughter was a tragic accident and a mistake, urging prosecutors in Grenada County, Mississippi, to drop the charges against her ex, the 8-month-old's father, Josh Blunt, who went to work May 19th, forgetting the girl was in the back of his car. Blunt's daughter was alive when they found her 4 hours later, but then died from the heat. He was initially charged with second-degree murder, but is now accused of manslaughter and set to go on trial next week. KidsAndCars.org reports 26 children have died after being left in hot vehicles this year, more than double the number at the same time in 2015. Dave Anthony, Fox News.
A whitewater rafting course in North Carolina is back open 6 weeks after a visitor died from a brain-eating amoeba. They drained the channels and installed a new chlorination system to kill microbes. Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Welcome to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Glad to have you listening to the program today on this Wednesday. Hope you're having a great day, and thank you for spending a few moments with us here on What Matters in North Carolina. If you'd like to call the program, you certainly may do that at 919-747-9421. You can also engage with us on Twitter if you'd like, at What Matters NC, and you can tweet at me at Mark Shiver. Well, the Civitas Action ratings for Senate and House members have been released for the 2016 legislative session. And lo and behold, only six in the House, it looks like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, actually 10 in the House got a ranking of 100. And one of those, not surprisingly, is Representative John Blust. He represents the good folks in Guilford County in Greensboro. Representative Blust, welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina.
Hey, good to be here. Good to talk to you again.
Well, I've always felt like if anybody will give it to you straight, it's Representative John Blust. So wanted to have you on today to talk about, obviously, judicial intervention and, you know, legislation by judicial action that we've been seeing so much here, particularly from the Fourth Circuit. I'll just tee you up and let you hit that ball.
Well, I think one of the things going on, not that there weren't a lot of liberal activists on the bench and on the Fourth Circuit already, but I think the death of Justice Scalia has emboldened some of the appellate courts into thinking that since Scalia's not there and there's no 5-4 conservative majority on the Supreme Court to reverse this, we, for our circuits, are pretty much the Supreme Court on issues that may have political significance. So I wonder if they would have been so bold had Scalia still been there and they've known they might get rebuked with a 5-4 reversal at the high court.
Well, that certainly is a question that bears asking, and unfortunately we won't be able to answer it. Justice Scalia obviously and absolutely is missed. Talk about the 2013 voter legislation that was passed here. You guys worked long and hard on that. I felt like it was common sense, felt like that it did not discriminate against anyone. I didn't feel like it suppressed anyone's vote. And yet the Fourth Circuit, three-judge panel, by the way, not even the full court, just three judges, three very liberal judges, just basically skewered that whole piece of legislation. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it was a political decision on their part. One of the ironies is North Carolina in that law is not doing anything out of the ordinary if you look at the laws from other states. Now, the liberals claim the voter ID component of that law is more strict as to exactly what IDs you have to show to comply, but voter ID has been upheld by the United States Supreme Court in a law similar to ours, I think out of Indiana, as not being an undue burden and really being common sense. So I really think they got the voter ID wrong. Now, some of the other opponents, one, we eliminated same-day registration. Well, most states do not have same-day registration. Therefore, are those states discriminating? Most states do not allow out-of-precinct voting, a simple control that you've really got to have to be able to administer elections. Are the other states that don't allow that, are they discriminating? There's many states that don't have early voting at all. So we were found to be discriminating because we cut it back from 17 days to 10 days, but then lengthened the hours of those days to, I think, where we had the same total hours. Another component was stopping the pre-registration of 17-year-olds because we knew that a lot of 17-year-olds are in transition and they turn 18 and they move to get a job or they move to go to college. And it really didn't make sense to add a lot of names to voter rolls that already studies show there's about, I think, a fifth to a fourth of the voters
officially registered aren't there. So we're not doing anything out of the ordinary, and I take strong exception to the left's continual use of this phrase, voter suppression. There is not one eligible voter, had our law stayed in effect, not one single eligible voter that could not have voted very easily. So there was no voter suppression, and it's really a bald-faced lie they tell to try to get an emotional reaction against the law.
Well, I don't disagree with you at all. I think that many times on this program, I have made the statement that there's no one who would not have been allowed to vote. I mean, not only do most people, the vast majority of people have identification. I mean, you can't do anything really in this world today without having some form of ID. But then you guys in the General Assembly tweaked the bill with the reasonable impediments provision. And then, you know, lo and behold, you could vote absentee if you wanted to without any kind of ID. So
exactly.
To say it was suppression, I agree with you, is totally incorrect.
And it really is poisoning the well of any sort of political discourse when the left on this and almost everything goes into hysteria to really keep there from being any rational discussions on the merit of almost any subject. They just launch into a tirade, bigoted, homophobic, haters, racists, and therefore you don't even get to the point of having a normal discussion. And I just don't see where we're headed over time, given their attitude.
Well, our guest is Representative John Blust, and he represents the good folks in Guilford County in the Greensboro area. And Representative Blust, maybe you can help me understand this. Not only did they strike down the law saying that there was racist intent, but it seems like now they've gone to demanding how many days we have of early voting, and we see now in Wake County, the court today is announcing what kind of maps that have to be used in the county commission and school board elections. It's almost like you guys could just pack it up and go home. We don't need the General Assembly anymore because the court is doing all the legislating for us.
Well, I'm a big advocate and a big student of the Constitution, and have had I been alive in the initial years, I would have been a Federalist. But the courts are really making the case of the anti-Federalists back when the Constitution ratification was being debated. The courts were not intended to usurp these type functions, and there just simply isn't anything in the Constitution or its penumbras that would say what we did in the voter election law bill is contrary to the Constitution. And it's a very dangerous course they're on, especially this disparate impact jurisdiction, meaning, hey, we can infer that you were racist or had racial animus because it might affect African Americans more than someone else. Well, my next question is, can we have criminal laws at all now? Because the criminal laws tend to impact African American defendants more than Caucasians or other races. So it is a very dangerous jurisprudence to say anything that impacts someone more than another group, and there's that dividing everyone into group that's really not constitutional, is going to be suspect. And I don't know. I'm hoping against hope that the United States Supreme Court will somehow still ride to the rescue and basically save the rule of law. Right now, it's looking like we're no longer under rule of law. And there was a hopeful sign last week, or was it the week before, when the Supreme Court stayed and agreed to hear the appeal from the Fourth Circuit on that Virginia bathroom law.
Yeah.
So there might be a little bit of common sense left, but once Hillary Clinton gets through with the courts, I don't know what there is to do.
Well, that certainly is a scary thought. Our guest on What Matters in North Carolina, Representative John Blust of the North Carolina House of Representatives. When you're sitting now pondering the response and as a legislator, what you can do, I mean, what can you guys do? There doesn't seem to be any kind of, at least at the state level, any kind of response that you can have to rein in the actions of the courts. Now, I believe that the Congress has some opportunity, if they were to take it, to rein in the courts and the jurisdiction that they have. But it must be very frustrating, Representative Blust, as a state representative, to have hard work just undone.
Well, I tell you one thing. It shows the wisdom of Jesse Helms, who used to be oft criticized for blocking these Fourth Circuit appointments from North Carolina. And I noticed Judge Wynn was one of those people, just a liberal ideologue. And I am a little disappointed when Republican senators help these people get confirmed, because the left is just, they're dug in more than conservatives or Republicans are. They block judges they don't like, and then we end up giving in, and over time, the federal bench is getting more and more drifting to the left. And our people better realize you better do scorched earth to keep these liberal ideologues off the bench to begin with, because once you get them on there, there's not much you can do.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the thought of so many people are saying that, never Trump and this and that about Trump. And I'm certainly we're not really endorsing candidates on this show. But I will say that if anything would keep me up at night, it's the thought of Hillary Clinton appointing one or more, maybe three justices to the United States Supreme Court. I mean, that's a nightmare.
Well, it is. And I'm not sure what kind of judges that Trump would appoint, but I am sure what kind Hillary Clinton would appoint. And we just can't bear anymore. And I hope, if the argument is you got to keep the Senate in Republican hands to keep damage from happening, well, they better dig in on these judges and fight to the end. I mean, if they say, hey, my goodness, we've only got eight on the Supreme Court, well, I'd keep eight before I'd ever go to another liberal ideologue there.
Absolutely.
And the Democrats were sure willing to do that. They borked Bork. Then they borked somebody else after that. And Anthony Kennedy, who sometimes goes their way, and I'm holding my breath on even now, is the justice who would have been Robert Bork. So the left has no compunction about digging in on something and not having originalists and good, those who will actually interpret the Constitution in light of what it really means. They keep our people from going on, common sense justices, but we all, I guess, hey, we get good press. And I'll tell you one thing, as a Republican conservative, you can forget really getting good press. It's just not going to happen. And to try to throw them a bone every now and then to get a little nice thing said about you, it's not going to get there. I mean, the things they do, here's people at the DNC that have died mysteriously in the last few weeks since the email hack. That's not even, it doesn't interest the mainstream press. But if Trump says, if Trump breathes hard, it's another major blow up to them. And you're not going to get good calls out of the media. You're just not. And you can forget it. And that they're now to the point they're helping to whip up the hysteria on all sorts of things.
Absolutely. Well, Representative Blust, I hope that things will somehow get better. And you mentioned Justice Wynn. What's interesting about him is a couple of years ago when they were taking questions about the voter legislation, he makes the comment that well, if a precinct is closer to my home than the one I'm supposed to vote at, I should be able to go there. Just showing a real lack of understanding about precincts and districts. And that kind of was a telltale sign right there that
yep.
he had really no respect for the process.
Well, they don't. They want a certain outcome, and they'll use the law to determine that outcome that they desire. And I guarantee if it was reversed and he thought voting in precinct would help in a specific precinct would help get the results he wants in policy, he'd suddenly say that the law is clear that you should vote in precincts. And we all know common sense. If you don't divide areas and have them go to a specific polling place, the confusion and the difficulty in actually administering the elections grows exponentially. So it is common sense, and it is sound. There's sound reasons for voting in your precinct. It's not too much to ask a voter to figure out where they need to vote. That's not suppression. It's never been known as suppression. It's not done. And I know Wynn can now, I guess, do what John Edwards did with the unborn baby in that one case. He can read the legislature's mind. He knows that we as a total unit are discriminatory and racist. Although I think that opinion said we are not saying that any of the individual legislators are racists. So collectively, somehow you add us all together and you've got racism, even though none of us individually is racist. The idiocy of this is just beyond human comprehension.
Well, I don't think I could say it any better, so I think I'll leave it right there. Representative Lust, you never fail to disappoint. You're articulate and stand up for what you believe in. And for that, us citizens out here in North Carolina appreciate all that you do in the House of Representatives. And thank you for being our guest on What Matters in North Carolina.
Thank you for having me.
Representative John Blust, I love it. The idiocy of this is just beyond comprehension. Yeah, that's right. It is absolute idiocy what we are faced with by the activist judges that are striking down North Carolina legislation left and right. You know, Blueprint North Carolina several years ago came out with some plans that were discovered when emails were released that said they want to eviscerate the governor and they want to do all of these things to the Republicans. And boy, I bet they're just, you know, over there popping corks on champagne, what they have been able to do of late. And it's really a shame, because when you really stop and ask yourself the question, why would you not want to have people showing identification when they vote? Is there a good reason not to show identification when you vote? I can't think of any. Oh, well, maybe if that person is not really who they say they are. Well, that would be the only reason that I guess I could come up with. If you want to try to engage in some type of nefarious activity, then sure, no need to have an ID. Object to having an ID. Let's not have any kind of things in place to ensure integrity in our elections. No ID. Let's let people register the same day and vote. That way we can't verify they are who they say they are. And let's let people just vote in any precinct. I think maybe all of the Republican registered voters should just wander around the state on election day and just vote anywhere they want to. I'm kidding, of course. But it's just absurd. Where are the reasoned, common sense people in this state? And maybe they are out there and they're just quiet. Maybe it's because all we really hear is the noise from the mainstream media, which has been proven time and time again to be very liberal-leaning and very biased against conservatism and people of faith and common sense and reason. But how could anybody be against preserving the integrity of an election? I just do not understand how that could be the case. Nope, no ID. Just come on up and vote. We don't need to know that you are who you say you are. And I've said this before, but it bears repeating, because the Fourth Circuit panel said that there was racism, racial intent involved in the voter legislation of 2013. Which, by the way, they could not prove. They just made this allegation. So when you are a representative of a leftist organization and you are glossing an entire group of people as either unable or unwilling to abide by the law and obtain a voter ID, that, to me, is gross discrimination. Well, African Americans just can't get ID cards. That's the bottom line. What is that? If African American people, as a community, should rise up against that kind of stereotyping that the left does of their community all the time. I mean, really, I find that offensive. And I think that African Americans should find it offensive too. What you're saying when you say that African Americans cannot get IDs, they're less likely to get IDs, what are you saying? Are you saying A, they don't want to get IDs? B, they don't know how to get IDs? See, they just are intent on disobeying the law? Don't care? I mean, how many negative attributes do you assign to an entire community of people when you have the nerve to say that requiring an ID is discriminating against African Americans? I find that tasteless. And I wish the African-American community would listen to some of the great leaders that have come of late and said, look, stop treating our community like we're criminals and like we're lawbreakers and like we are just a set of demographic numbers to be used. Why does the African-American community put up with this? It's mind-blowing. They should be up in arms over people like William Barber and Bob Hall and the Justice Center and the Southern Law, whoever they are, ACLU, just using them for their own political gain. And you saw it happen. Three judges on the Fourth Circuit struck down an entire set of legislation here in North Carolina that was not discriminatory, that would not have suppressed anyone's vote. And they did it on the backs of African Americans, saying that this law was racist and you're going to suppress African American votes. Well, gee, it's so funny how the turnout in 2014 among African Americans was greater than it was in 2010 when we had this law in place as regards to early voting days. Gee, how discriminatory was that? Let's see. The turnout went up. Oh, my gosh, that's discriminatory. We're suppressing votes. How can you suppress votes when the turnout is greater? And yet, see, what we have here is we have judges who are not listening to common sense. They're not listening to reason, and they are not listening to the Constitution. They are listening to their own political ideology and their willingness to shred the Constitution. You are listening to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Thanks to Representative John Blust for being our guest. We're going to talk about the internet next. You are on the Freedom Action Network. Time for a Fox News update. We'll be right back.
News Radio, I'm Lisa Brady. An infamous serial killer is heading to death row in California. Fox Radio's Jessica Rosenthal, live in L.A.
Lisa, a judge in Los Angeles agreed with the jury that Lonnie Franklin Jr. should die for the murders he committed as the Grim Sleeper serial killer and sentenced him to death. Family members of victims like Porter Alexander spoke out in court.
Person like that, sitting over there, showing no remorse, sitting there like lump on the log, like everything is everything, and I did what I did, so what? But your time has come.
Franklin was convicted of murdering 9 women and a girl, though prosecutors say they believe he is linked to as many as 25 murders, Lisa.
Thanks, Jessica. A suspect in custody in Arkansas after 2 law enforcement officers were shot earlier today.
We have had deputies that responded to a disturbance down here off of 253.
Sebastian County Sheriff Bill Hollenbeck not yet confirming the condition of a wounded deputy. A Hackett police officer was treated and released from the hospital. A news conference expected next hour. The Pentagon now says tens of thousands of ISIS fighters have been killed over the past 2 years. Fox Radio's John Decker, live at the White House.
According to a top U.S. Army general in Iraq, the number of ISIS fighters has dropped precipitously over the last 24 months. Lieutenant General Sean McFarland spoke to reporters at a press briefing from Baghdad.
We estimate that over the past 11 months, we've killed about 25,000 enemy fighters. When you add that to the 20,000 estimated killed prior to our arrival, that's 45,000 enemy taken off the battlefield.
The first U.S. airstrikes against ISIS took place a little over 2 years ago. Lisa?
Thanks, John. An hour to the close on Wall Street. Stocks are lower. The Dow is down 59 points. Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
Take an ordinary putty knife and scrape off the old wax ring. Place the new wax ring over the flange, then line up the bolts with the bowl and gently set in place, making sure a proper seal is created with the flange and drain. Next?
Dad?
Yeah, sweetie.
Is that an old plumbing manual?
Oh, yeah, honey.
We really need to get some new books.
Right, do you want me to stop?
Nah, I kind of want to know how it ends.
Okay. Tighten the bolts, line up the flushing valve to the opening in the top of the bowl, and secure the tank with a screwdriver and crescent wrench.
The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
A Justice Department probe that started after the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore finds a pattern of discrimination violating constitutional rights.
We know that our citizens are outraged at some of the details included in this report, and they should be.
Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis says bias will not be tolerated. The city's working with the Justice Department on reforms, some officers already fired. A 73-year-old librarian accidentally shot dead during a role-playing event with police in Punta Gorda, Florida. A state investigation underway.
We have complete faith in our chief of police to ensure that this outside investigation is conducted thoroughly.
City Manager Howard Kunick calls the accident horrific, offering deepest sympathy to the family and friends of Mary Knowlton. Police say it's affected the entire community, that a local hospice has arranged for grief counseling at no cost. No word yet on what may have killed sportscaster John Saunders. The ESPN veteran was 61. It's no secret the water in Rio is polluted, but what's up with the pool water used for the diving competition?
Maybe the water here in Rio is just really patriotic. No, divers are blaming yesterday's sunshine and warm temperatures for an algae bloom that turned the diving pool green at the Maria Lenk Aquatic Stadium. This morning, its neighboring water polo pool began taking on a green tinge as well, but the weather is very different. Cool, windy, and raining. Organizers say they tested the water and it is safe, so they're allowing competition competitions to go on as scheduled. Women's synchronized diving finals took place in the Greenwater yesterday, men's synchronized diving and water polo today. Athletes say it's harder to see under the water for divers. That means seeing the bottom of the pool. For water polo, that's for refs to see what physical play is going on beneath the surface. At the Olympics in Rio, Chris Honig, Fox News.
Meantime, the wind and rain have canceled rowing for the day and delayed tennis. Brady, Fox News Radio.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina. My name is Mark Shiver. Thank you for listening to the program here on a Wednesday. Yes, it's hot, but it has been worse, so we're thankful for about that. And we won't complain too much, although I have been known to complain more than most people about hot weather. Anyway, thanks to Representative Jod Blust, one of North Carolina's best members in the House of Representatives, stand-up guy, will always tell you what is on his mind, and he will vote in line with what he says. He won't tell you one thing and then vote another way. He's absolute representative with complete integrity as far as I'm concerned. And we appreciate him being on What Matters in North Carolina and sharing his thoughts on the recent judicial activism that we have seen in the Fourth Circuit regarding North Carolina's voter ID and other legislation. Well, now, there's a topic I'll bet that you are not really familiar with. And the reason I say that is because I have been on the periphery of this topic. I've been aware of it, but it's not something that is front and center. But golly, it sure should be. And it's the topic of internet freedom. And before you think, oh boy, you better listen, because this is serious stuff, folks. And to break it all down for us and to help us to understand what is going on and what is at risk, our guest is Baron Soka, president and founder of Tech Freedom. Baron, welcome to What Matters in North Carolina.
Thanks for having me.
Well, there are a lot of initials here, and so I'm going to get you to help us break all of this down. IANA and NTIA and other things. But can you, in a nutshell, before we dig into the details here, tell us what's going on and why people should be concerned about the topic of internet freedom.
Right. So bottom line, two fundamental issues. Number one, internet freedom, who governs the internet, and what role foreign governments have, and whether this is all accountable to anybody. And number two, the constitutional principle that the Congress has the power of the purse, which is supposed to be at the heart of our democracy. Those two things are intersecting in this case. It's complicated, and so people have had a hard time getting their arms around it, but I think I can unpack it in a way that will allow everybody to see why it matters.
Okay, let me, I think most people, anybody at all that may have registered a domain name, I've done that personally. I think a lot of people have done that. But right now it's a pretty easy process. And who is in charge of all of that right now?
Well, so it's private companies that you deal with when you register the domain name, but that system that ties the internet together in a single global network of networks that makes sure that domain names work across the planet is administered by a private California nonprofit called ICANN. And that essentially has become a sort of quasi-government for the internet since it was set up back in 1998. As an alternative to having the federal government directly administer that. And that's not a bad thing, but that organization has become, as I said, more and more of a government. It now has a budget in the hundreds of millions of dollars. It brings in a lot of money as new top-level domain names like .hotel are put up for auction. And so it's becoming more and more like a government. And the fundamental question here is, how will we ensure that that body remains accountable to the stakeholders, the end users, the private companies, the civil society groups, the technical experts, and that body is not captured by foreign governments or supplant it, because there are foreign governments who want to move from that multi-stakeholder model where they exert only indirect influence to a more United Nations model where things would be resolved on a one country, one vote basis, and where they would be able to really implement their censorship and surveillance agenda.
Our guest, Baron Soka here, president and founder of Tech Freedom. Now, you correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going to try to follow along because I went to school in South Carolina. I'm not very smart. But so ICON, which is the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, right now, everything kind of funnels through them when it comes to domain names and URLs and all that kind of stuff. So currently, they are they're not under the control of the United States, are they? But they're pretty well playing ball the way the United States wants them to. Is that accurate?
Well, this is a subtle point. Some of your listeners may have noticed during Senator Cruz's speech at the Republican convention that he alluded to this issue when he said we shouldn't give away the internet to Russia and China.
Right.
This is what he was talking about.
Okay.
And there are a few different positions you can take on this. One of them is that the United States government has had a historic role. It set up ICANN in the first place, and it has had a contract with ICANN since 1998 to administer the technical function that ultimately makes all the domain names work across the planet, and that's called IANA. That's one of those acronyms you mentioned.
Yeah.
And the specific issue that's brewing is back in spring of 2014, the administration announced that after 16 years, they were going to start moving towards letting that contract lapse. In other words, they were going to, quote, transition from the current role where the U.S. government essentially has been a sort of backstop, has been the guarantor of internet governance, if only because they could at least keep ICANN, that private nonprofit, in check by threatening to re-award the contract to administer this technical function to some other body. And so the administration has said, we're done with that. We're going to transition to ICANN running this. We want ICANN to make some reforms to make sure that the stakeholders, the private sector and technical groups and civil society groups, remain in charge. And ICANN did, to its credit, the community, really, to its credit, of those stakeholders, worked on a huge package of reforms, and the administration has signed off on them and is ready to let this contract lapse at the end of September. But there are a lot of unanswered questions about how this is going to work, and so groups like mine, Tech Freedom, are concerned that if we move forward without addressing these questions, things like, is ICANN going to remain based in California? And what mechanisms does the community have to keep the CEO of the organization in check? I mean, the most recent CEO has now been getting involved with China in its efforts to take over internet governance, and it hired the guy, the Minister of Communications in Egypt, who quite literally flipped the internet kill switch. So this is not to demonize ICANN, because I think, to paraphrase Winston Churchill, that it's the worst form of internet governance except for all the others. but my concern is that we're about to make a profoundly important leap, and it's a leap of faith that requires that these elaborate governance mechanisms, just think about any nonprofit that you're involved in, it's always the case that the members and the board are going to be in tension, and the board and the CEO might do things that the members don't really want. And you don't necessarily have a lot of control, especially here, because the stakeholders were not able to actually get legal rights as members under California nonprofit law. That's just one of many, many questions that have not been resolved here. And unfortunately, the administration, while they did extend the contract for 1 year about around this time last year, they don't seem willing to do that now. They seem to be driven by a purely political deadline. They want to get this resolved while they're still in office, and they don't really seem to care that there are still these unanswered questions. And so they seem to be planning to let this contract lapse, which means, according to their logic, that ICAN would then take over this function, and the U.S. government would no longer have this role of ultimately being the guarantor, the check on ICAN. And if that happens, number one, that's a potentially huge problem for internet governance, and it may take a long time to see whether these reforms really will keep the organization in check or whether it will become a more unaccountable government, just as our own president has become unaccountable. And you could see the same happening for the CEO of ICANN. And then second, there's this constitutional issue. Congress twice told the administration not to let this contract lapse, not to relinquish its oversight or guarantor responsibilities. And that is still the law in an appropriations rider that says that the Commerce Department cannot spend taxpayer funds to relinquish their responsibility. And yet that is precisely what they're doing. And so we're urging Congress, members of both parties, to stand up for the power of the purse, just as the House did 2 years ago in the Obamacare case, where there was a similar issue about the power of Congress to make appropriations. And the administration was saying, no, we don't need you. We can do that on our own. So we think that the Congress has to stand up here on both internet freedom grounds and to defend the power of the purse.
Wow. Barrett Soka, freaking me out a little bit here on what matters in North Carolina. This is the kind of thing, Barron, that happens when nobody's looking. And fortunately, you're looking, and we certainly appreciate that you are, because I guarantee you I could walk into the mall right now and ask 100 people, and 100 people would not have any idea of any of this. And yet, somebody said to me, and you can tell me if you think this is an accurate consequence, potentially, if Congress does not do what they need to do on this. If I wanted to go out and register SecondAmendmentRights.com, that might not be possible if things do not stay the way that they are now, or if ICANN is allowed to have other influences from foreign governments. Is that accurate?
Well, it's complicated. I mean, the short answer is that right now, the First Amendment has ensured that you can get a domain name like that. The concern that we and others have is ultimately that as we start drifting away from the U.S. law, and as ICANN starts talking about, quote, human rights, which is sort of code for things like, well, you know, we believe in free speech, except when it comes to hate speech or speech we don't like. Well, if that happens, and I think it really will, if ICANN continues on its current course, then you could in the future see an attempt to start making editorial decisions like that. So I don't want to scare people overly, because many people will say, well, you're overreacting and that's not happening now. But our point is that we are moving away from a model of internet governance that has been firmly grounded in the First Amendment, where we knew that that kind of thing wouldn't happen. And we're moving into a world where we don't know what's going to happen, and there are still major unanswered questions, and the administration is just not taking them seriously.
So, not to be a conspiratorial, but our guest, Barron Soka, president and founder of Tech Freedom, can I say that the Obama administration, that there's something nefarious here, that they want to have this change that you have described take place? Or is this just members of Congress being lazy or not understanding? Or what's really the driving force behind this?
So there's two drivers. So number one is the administration certainly has a point that ultimately the U.S. government has been on a trajectory to remove itself from internet governance. So I am very skeptical about governance in general, and I don't want the U.S. government to own or control the internet either. However, then the question becomes, well, the U.S. government has had this role as a guarantor through this contract for the IANA function, which, as I said, and it could at least take away from ICANN if ICANN went off the rails, and it could use that as leverage. Right. So what I wanted to see happen was for the U.S. government, if it wasn't going to retain some role like that, at least to really, really strike a hard bargain to get governance concerns addressed. Not governments, but governance of ICANN. Now, they didn't do that, and I think they didn't because of some combination of genuine thinking that if we didn't do this, that we would play into the hands of foreign governments who want to replace ICANN with a UN model. But also, frankly, they're being driven by a political agenda here. They have viewed this, of doing this, as a way to recover the kind of stature that the president had when he came into office. Remember, he was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize just for smiling and being a nice guy and not being George W. Bush. And then because of the Snowden revelations was just reviled around the world. And the clock ticked by and the administration didn't do anything about surveillance reform. And they needed some way to recover their credibility and goodwill internationally on internet issues. And so they seized on this. And that, I think, is really what has continued to drive them. And they just want to get it done during their watch so the president can claim that he was the president that removed the U.S. government's control over the internet and fully privatized it.
Wow. So you mentioned a letter earlier, and our guest is president and founder of Tech Freedom, Baron Soka, and I really appreciate the information and the way that you're able to articulate this and explain it in a way that, that we can understand it. Our listeners, I'm confident, are really getting a lot out of this. And that being said, there is a letter that you mentioned that you and tell me who else is going to be sending. Who are you sending it to, and how can our listeners help if they can?
Well, that will be out tomorrow. It'll be on the Tech Freedom website. It'll be easy to find, but it's from an array of groups across the community of people who are concerned about internet governance and concerned about constitutional separation of powers, some law professors, one of the founding chairmen of ICANN. That'll be coming out tomorrow. And we're sending that to congressional leaders and saying to them, look, the question here is really quite simple. Are you going to let the administration thumb its nose at you, even though you've told them not to let this go through? If you let that happen, then the appropriations power, the power of the purse, when you say don't do something, and the administration does it anyway, you will have essentially given up that power. And that would be a really fundamental shift in American constitutional law on top of all these concerns about internet governance, which, again, these could be addressed. I mean, ICANN is working on a second round of reform questions. That's not going to be resolved until next summer. So I just think it's crazy to do this transition now. There's no reason that we can't extend the contract for a year and at least let those questions be resolved. And then, you know, if Congress extends the rider, which I think they should, and continue to prohibit the transition for another year, ultimately Congress would get to sign off on this and have some say here. There's no reason why this should be entirely left up to the administration. And if the administration had bothered to talk to Congress before they did this, this would not be a partisan issue. They could have gotten Republicans on board and they could have worked through these concerns, but this is just typical of their MO. They don't want to work with anybody else, and they don't like the idea that there are other branches of government that might have a say.
Well, so can our listeners, they can go to your website, which is techfreedom.org, T-E-C-H, freedom.org. Can they sign off what will they be able to do?
Well, the letter will be up tomorrow. We haven't gotten a petition up yet, but that's certainly not a bad idea. And we may do that. We've been working on a few other things, one of which actually involves North Carolina. There's a court case today where the FCC lost a major battle in its effort to rewrite state laws about government-run broadband. So if you want to have me on about that, we can talk about that, and maybe we can do a follow-up on what happens here on this letter.
Okay, well, we definitely want to have you back on, and we can talk about that. Maybe We can hit you up on Friday if the letter's going up tomorrow, and we'll see how that goes. Does that work for you?
Sure. Anytime. Always happy to come back. I did go to school in North Carolina, and I loved it. And I have to say, I continue to be impressed by the number of groups and outlets in North Carolina that care about these issues. There are too many places in this country, honestly, where people just don't care anymore about constitutional niceties.
Well, we've been getting hammered here, as you know, by judicial activism. And so if there was any form of winning at the federal level that involves North Carolina, I'm sure it will be a breath of fresh air. But I'll get in touch with you. We'll find out what the best day, the most effective time to get you back on so that our listeners will be able to be most informed about this issue and maybe talk about the win, which would certainly be, like I said, a breath of fresh air. Baron Soka, you are absolutely awesome. Thank you so much for spending time with us today on What Matters in North Carolina. And we look forward to talking with you again really soon.
Thanks for having me.
Well, I hope that you understood a lot of that, folks. What I could basically sum it up to say is that Congress needs to do their job. They need to renew a contract with this company that has been servicing the internet and keeping the internet, running in an organized way in terms of things like assigning names. It's the Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers, ICON, ICANN. So there's a letter that Tech Freedom and Baron Soka and his group is getting together, as he said, signed off on by a lot of other folks. I believe we here at the Civitas are going to be encouraging that as well. And so I will remind you tomorrow, but jot this down, techfreedom.org, T-E-C-H, freedom.org. And you might be thinking, man, this is boring. Well, you know, again, in the extreme, and I know our producer, Matt, is, active in the area of Second Amendment rights, has a show here on the Freedom Action Network, NC Gun Dad. But I gathered from his response, Matt, that not to scare anybody, but if this issue is not resolved, we could see, as he said, foreign countries involved with the regulation of these names, and suddenly the ability to have ncgundad.com or whatever, if you don't already have it. I'm just using that as an example. That might not be available to you.
Well, I think it would be available, but it might be ncgundad.china.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think this is a real issue that we need to be concerned about because, as he said, you get into First Amendment issues here. But, I mean, wouldn't you agree things pretty well run fairly smoothly right now the way it is in terms of being able to I mean, I could go on right now while we're on the air and create a domain name if it were available if somebody else didn't already have it. And I can have that done within 3 or 4 minutes. So it's easy.
Right. And it seems to be working really well. And there's been industry that comes up around it. GoDaddy is the one that, of course, comes to mind for domain registrations. And it seems to really work pretty like a well-oiled machine. So I'm really a fan of the, if it ain't broke, I'm not touching it. I mean, I'm not going to, go in and advocate for screwing up something that's already working or possibly screwing up something that's already working very well.
Well, yeah, and I would agree with that. So a lot of this is technical. I mean, there are too many initials here. There's ICANN, Internet Corporation for Assigned Names and Numbers. Then there's the National Telecommunications and Information Administration, NTIA. You have the Internet Assigned Numbers Authority, which is IANA. But the bottom line is that Congress needs to defend its power of the purse and internet freedom. And that's the bottom line of what this letter that our guest Baron Soka, the folks at Tech Freedom and others, right, many others, by the way, are going to be sending to Speaker Ryan and Majority Leader McConnell. And so keep your eye out on this one, folks. Keep your ears perked and tuned to What Matters in North Carolina, because this does matter in North Carolina. A lot of times we hit issues that are national, but everything that we talk about really has an impact on those of us who live here in North Carolina and enjoy the freedoms that we have in our country. So, great guest. Thank you, Baron Soka. We're going to take a brief time out for your Fox News update, and we're going to get back. We had him on last week, but Greg Stebbins was at a meeting in Raleigh last night. We want to talk to him about something we talked about last week, short-term rentals. How's that going to happen in Raleigh? Is it going to happen, and what would be the impact? So you're listening to What Matters in North Carolina. We'll be right back.
News Radio, I'm Lisa Brady. An infamous serial killer is heading to death row in California. Fox Radio's Jessica Rosenthal, live in L.A.
Lisa, a judge in Los Angeles agreed with the jury that Lonnie Franklin Jr. should die for the murders he committed as the Grim Sleeper serial killer and sentenced him to death. Family members of victims like Porter Alexander spoke out in court.
Person like that, sitting over there, showing no remorse, sitting there like lump on the log, like everything is everything, and I did what I did, so what? But your time has come.
Franklin was convicted of murdering 9 women and a girl, though prosecutors say they believe he is linked to as many as 25 murders, Lisa.
Thanks, Jessica. A suspect in custody in Arkansas after 2 law enforcement officers were shot earlier today.
We have had deputies that responded to a disturbance down here off of 253.
Sebastian County Sheriff Bill Hollenbeck not yet confirming the condition of a wounded deputy. A Hackett police officer was treated and released from the hospital. A news conference expected next hour. The Pentagon now says tens of thousands of ISIS fighters have been killed over the past 2 years. Fox Radio's John Decker, live at the White House.
According to a top U.S. Army general in Iraq, the number of ISIS fighters has dropped precipitously over the last 24 months. Lieutenant General Sean McFarland spoke to reporters at a press briefing from Baghdad.
We estimate that over the past 11 months, we've killed about 25,000 enemy fighters. When you add that to the 20,000 estimated killed prior to our arrival, that's 45,000 enemy taken off the battlefield.
The first U.S. airstrikes against ISIS took place a little over 2 years ago. Lisa?
Thanks, John. An hour to the close on Wall Street. Stocks are lower. The Dow is down 59 points. Fox News Radio, fair and balanced.
Take an ordinary putty knife and scrape off the old wax ring. Place the new wax ring over the flange, then line up the bolts with the bowl and gently set in place, making sure a proper seal is created with the flange and drain. Next?
Dad?
Yeah, sweetie?
Is that an old plumbing manual?
Oh, yeah, honey.
We really need to get some new books.
Right, do you want me to stop?
Nah, I kind of want to know how it ends.
Okay. Tighten the bolts, line up the flushing valve to the opening in the top of the bowl, and secure the tank with a screwdriver and crescent wrench.
The smallest moments can have the biggest impact on a child's life. Take time to be a dad today. Call 877-4DAD-411 or visit fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
A Justice Department probe that started after the death of Freddie Gray in Baltimore finds a pattern of discrimination violating constitutional rights.
We know that our citizens are outraged at some of the details included in this report, and they should be.
Baltimore Police Commissioner Kevin Davis says bias will not be tolerated. The city's working with the Justice Department on reforms, some officers already fired. A 73-year-old librarian accidentally shot dead during a role-playing event with police in Punta Gorda, Florida. A state investigation underway.
We have complete faith in our chief of police to ensure that this outside investigation is conducted thoroughly.
City Manager Howard Kunick calls the accident horrific, offering deepest sympathy to the family and friends of Mary Knowlton. Police say it's affected the entire community, that a local hospice has arranged for grief counseling at no cost. No word yet on what may have killed sportscaster John Saunders. The ESPN veteran was was 61. It's no secret the water in Rio is polluted, but what's up with the pool water used for the diving competition?
Maybe the water here in Rio is just really patriotic. No, divers are blaming yesterday's sunshine and warm temperatures for an algae bloom that turned the diving pool green at the Maria Lenk Aquatic Stadium. This morning, its neighboring water polo pool began taking on a green tinge as well, but the weather is very different. Cool, windy, and raining. Organizers say they tested the water and it is safe, so they're allowing competitions to go on as scheduled. Women's synchronized diving finals took place in the green water yesterday, men's synchronized diving and water polo today. Athletes say it's harder to see under the water. For divers, that means seeing the bottom of the pool. For water polo, that's for refs to see what physical play is going on beneath the surface. At the Olympics in Rio, Chris Honig, Fox News.
Meantime, the wind and rain have canceled rowing for the day and delayed tennis. Brady, Fox News Radio.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina on this Wednesday here in the Old North State. Hope you're having a great day. We are having a great show and very excited to have talked with Representative John Blust earlier and also to Baron Soka of Tech Freedom and just getting some content and information that's just really fantastic today. So if you missed either of those two segments, do not despair. You can download the show anytime as a podcast. Go to freedomactionnetwork.com, click the listen button, and you can do it there. You can go to the iTunes and Google Play stores also and listen to the show at your leisure. I would encourage you, really, to text your friends a link to the show. Tell them, hey, you need to listen to this this guy, Mark Shiver. You need to listen to this show. The guests they're having are just outrageous. And send them an email. Send them the link. Post it on Facebook, Twitter. The momentum for this show is building. People are listening. We're getting positive feedback and really fast becoming the go-to conservative talk show in North Carolina. And so do that. Spread the word. Word of mouth is always the best advertising, so we appreciate that. You can follow us on Twitter at WhatMattersNC. You can hit me up at Mark Shiver. And we had Greg Stebbin on the show last week to talk about political conventions and his book, White House Confidential, the little book of weird presidential history, which I would encourage you to check out on Amazon or Barnes & Noble, wherever you do your book shopping. But Greg is well-versed, known Greg for years, and knows a lot about a lot. And so one of those things happens to be going on right here in Raleigh, the short-term rental situation. Now, before I bring Greg on, I just want to remind you, last week we talked about Austin, Texas, and how they have actually passed ordinances that grossly appear on the surface to violate the Constitution. They have the ability to enter homes if it appears that activity is going on later than 10 o'clock at night. And I was talking to a lawyer, and he said, absolutely. If they feel like, I mean, you could be up sitting playing cards with your family and they could enter your house without a warrant. And so this will probably not pass constitutional muster, but, you know, things are going to have to be litigated. And you know that that's expensive and drawn out. And you can't have more than six adults on the property in Austin, Texas. So if you had your husband and wife and several kids and an aunt and uncle, you might get... you might get a fine and a citation. And so the city of Austin, very aggressive in the whole realm of short-term rentals. And basically what we're talking about is you own a piece of property and you want to rent it out 30 days, maybe a college kid or three or four college kids, maybe for 4 months, anything less than 6 months. Greg Stebbin, is that correct? Less than 6 months?
Well, it's... different cities and different municipalities have different rules. So here in Raleigh, for instance, a short-term rental is anything less than 30 days.
Oh, okay. So it's much shorter than of a time frame.
Yeah, I mean, if you were going to rent a place for 6 months, you would probably have a traditional long-term lease. And that is, of course, allowed, and there doesn't seem to be any problem with it, which frankly does make you wonder why. I mean, look, we all, anyone who owns a home knows that when you buy your home, there's a good chance some of the homes in your neighborhood will be rented instead of lived in by the owner of the house itself, and we accept that. And it's a little mystifying to me why people get so up in arms about short-term rentals. They'll talk about, well, you know, you have a lot of people coming and going in the neighborhood. Well, I come and go from my house all the time. That's my prerogative. I come and go in the neighborhood. It's a really complicated issue, and I have to tell you, I think people who are afraid of it are mostly afraid of something they don't really understand.
Well, Greg Stebbin, author of, 10 books, including his latest, White House Confidential, the little book of weird presidential history. I might have to hit you up for an anecdote before you hang up, but why don't you break it down?
I'm always ready with an anecdote.
Break it down for us, Greg. What is the deal here?
Well, so first of all, just a little history on what's been going on here in Raleigh. The issue's been before the city council for well over a year and a half. And I'm sort of amazed to say that the issue actually erupted surrounding me and my house. I bought a house in the Five Points area about, I guess, 2.5 years ago. And there's a granny unit that we thought my wife's father might move into. And he's just a really nice guy. He's stubborn and won't move. So we sort of jokingly thought, well, we'll rent it on Airbnb. And I did something that turns out to have been very important. As I was signing up for Airbnb, and maybe I should even talk about what Airbnb and short-term rentals really are, because I'm not sure everybody knows. So Airbnb is one of a handful of successful businesses where people like me rent out part of their house to visitors to the city. So you can think of it as like, I think most people know what Uber is. It's kind of like Uber for your house. So if you have a granny unit, as I do, this granny unit has a separate entrance. We have people who we screen before we rent to them. They have their own key to the lock. They come and go. And frankly, it's a nice revenue generator. And there are about 500 of these short-term rentals here in Raleigh.
Okay.
So to get back to my story, which is important, at the time, I actually called the city, the planning commission and the zoning commission. And I asked, you know, can I do this? Is it legal? And what I was told was that they had heard of short-term rental companies like Airbnb, but they weren't sure if it was legal or not. And then the next thing they said was important. They basically said, you might as well go ahead and do it if you want, because we would never bother you unless someone complained. And ironically, and you know what? I mean, that, some people have said, well, that's a crazy answer, but it's not. I mean, as with any company or organization or city government, you have limited resources. The planning or the zoning people are not out looking for trouble. They know there's trouble when a neighbor calls and complains. And lo and behold, ironically, somebody complained about me renting out this part of my house on Airbnb. There was an anonymous complaint. I don't know who made the complaint. They weren't complaining about anything in particular. It wasn't because there was noise or a parking problem. They just said, basically, this guy's doing this thing. And you know what? I wish the neighbor, if it was a neighbor, would have come to me and said, what are you doing? And talked to me first, but he or she didn't. But they were well within their right to make that complaint because, as it turns out, the zoning department or the planning commission went back and took a closer look at the laws on the books, and they realized it's not legal. And so they issued me a citation. A few months later, the city council actually voted to stop, what's the right word for it, to stop enforcing those laws. So they basically said, anyone who wants to can go ahead and do it, until their intent was to allow it to continue until the city council came up with a formal plan that might include making this sort of short-term rental activity legal. And the irony is now, a year and a half later, they still have not resolved the issue.
Our guest is Greg Stebbin, and local, I guess, what, troublemaker here, Greg, trying to rent.
No, not by design, but yes, apparently I am a troublemaker.
Trying to rent his house out, and heaven forbid. But
well, and by the way, you know, I think there's an important piece of data here. So when my wife and I are fairly new to Raleigh, and by the way, we love living here.
Well, good.
But when we bought this house and decided to rent this room, we had to spend a little money to fix it up. And, you know, that's how business works. You make an investment and you hope you get it back. We wondered if we would ever get that money back because we thought to ourselves, who's going to come to Raleigh and stay in our house? Well, let me tell you what an amazing surprise it's been. We rent this room in our house out 27 to 28 nights a month.
Wow.
There's that kind of, and there's 500 people like us, some renting out whole houses, some renting out rooms, but there's that kind of demand. And I think it's important to understand that and also to remember that in the city of Raleigh, it has been well documented and well reported that there is a hotel shortage. We do not have enough hotel rooms in the city of Raleigh, and it actually hurts the convention center's ability to book bigger events. So wouldn't you think the city would look at people like us who are running successful businesses, generating tax revenue, and thank us for helping to house people instead of creating a sort of legislative black hole?
Well, you would think, but you know how governments are sometimes. But anyway, so where do we stand now? And now, as I was reading back in June, our guest Greg Stebbin talking about short-term rentals in Raleigh, North Carolina, the city council tied. They had a 4-4 vote, and so nothing was done.
Well, actually, the tie, interestingly enough, they tied on the idea of sending the issue to the Economic Development and Innovation Committee. So a tie was enough of a vote to make it the issue move to that committee, and that committee met yesterday. And that was a really important moment because that was the point at which it was really the first time Mayor McFarland, I think, really stood up and took a position on this. She wanted to see it resolved. I had the sense that she was an advocate for it, and why she wanted it to go to the Economic Development and Innovation Committee is that she heads that committee. Also, by the way, I want you to know that I've been waiting a year and a half for this to happen because, as I have said in the News and Observer and in the Indie Week and on Twitter and Facebook, I always felt that the most important way to look at this issue was not just to consider how neighbors felt about this, but also to look at it as a huge and important business issue. There is a lot of stakeholders involved in this issue. And if the city makes the wrong decision, it is, I believe, literally going to hurt the business climate in Raleigh.
Well, what did they do?
I'm going to be honest with you. It was a bit frustrating.
Uh-oh.
It was frustrating because this is the fourth or fifth time that this issue has gone from the city council to a committee and then having the committee kick it back to the city council in a completely unresolved way, almost like a Hail Mary pass, like, well, I hope the city council will figure it out because we're not going to figure it out. This committee spent all of an hour talking about this issue that's been debated for 18 months. I think it's pretty easy to see that an hour is not enough time to come up with a resolution. And I shared in a private meeting with the mayor yesterday and then before this committee that after this much time of trying to resolve this, perhaps this formal setting of city council meetings and committee meetings, where frankly, the only people that really get to talk are the council or the committee, but you have an audience full of people who actually have the knowledge and experience that could be useful in helping create a solution, I proposed that the right way to resolve this, given that 18 months has been spent coming up with no resolution, might be to actually create a task force, which I volunteered to do, bringing together stakeholders, and when I say stakeholders, I mean business people, I mean neighbors who don't like it, I mean neighbors who do like it, I mean building a good, balanced task force of people who don't sit in a committee meeting where there's, you know, it's a controlled environment, but actually sit around a table with a whiteboard and bounce ideas off of each other and brainstorm until they come up with a solution that it seems like just about everybody could agree on. And I was shocked that that idea was shot down given the amount of time and resources the city has already spent on this. And truthfully, I don't think what they passed yesterday is going to go anywhere anyway. And it's just unleashing a whole other series of meetings with nothing being resolved. It's very frustrating, and I think the process of governing at some point has to be declared the wrong process to solve some issues, and the way you know is when the issue doesn't get resolved.
Well, that certainly makes sense. Our guest, Greg Stebbins, he is an author of many books, the most recent of which is White House Confidential, The Little Book of Weird Presidential History, and resident of Raleigh, having a frustrating time dealing with the municipal powers that be over the topic of short-term rentals. So can you just very succinctly, because we're running up against it here, but what is the big deal? I mean, this seems to me to be a fundamental issue of private property rights. It's my house, and if I want to rent it, then I should be able to. There are ordinances in place for things like noise pollution, light pollution, et cetera, you know, trash, whatever. So if neighbors are worried about how the people who are renting your property or my property, there are ordinances in place ostensibly to deal with those things. So, Greg, what is the deal here? I mean, why can't you just rent your house?
You're asking me as if I have the... I wish you had been there to watch the city council meeting, because two city council members in particular were arguing exactly the same thing that you... One was arguing for, and one, most frustratingly, without having any data, any anecdotes to share, just kept pushing back and saying, well, you don't live in my neighborhood. In my neighborhood, it's a problem. The other city council member saying, well, show us some evidence of that. There is no evidence that there's a problem here. At the city council meeting on June 7th, and then again yesterday, at the city council meeting, we had about 65 people wearing bright yellow shirts. I was wearing one yesterday. And what it says on the shirt is 500 short-term rentals, 13,000 guests, 13,000 people used these short-term rentals in Raleigh last year. That's a big number. You want to guess of those 500 houses and 13,000 guests, you want to guess how many complaints there were?
I have no idea.
Seven.
Wow.
I live in Five Points, and on my block, there are 9 long-term rentals. 9. There were more complaints with the police last year about those 9 long-term rentals than all 500 long-term rentals in the city of Raleigh. So your point is a really good one. What's the problem? I understand that people are concerned about having strangers in their neighborhood and things like that. You live in a city. There will always be strangers on your street because I'm going to invite my friends and they're strange to you.
Well, before we let you go, there's really no resolution. Have they punted and it's going to be on next month's agenda, or is it just up in the air? What can we expect
next?
Going
back to the – so they did come up with a very – awkward ordinance that really is not any different than things they've already not been able to pass, and it's going back to the city council. And let me explain to you how convoluted this is. It goes back to the city council. The city council votes to send it back to the planning commission, which votes to send it to the text change committee, which then spends a few months writing something new. They've already done this 2 or 3 times. Then they vote to send it back to the planning commission, which votes to send it back to the city council, which votes to have a pub. We've been through this 2 or 3 or 4 times now. I don't know the number because I've lost track.
Well, sounds like
we have to say this is not working. We have to try something new, which is why I proposed a task force of stakeholders.
Well, it sounds like government at its finest. Greg Stebbins, you've got to give us an anecdote. Now, yesterday, Donald Trump said something interesting, I guess, to say the least.
I think I know where you're going with
it. You know, he said that the likelihood or the possibility exists that if Hillary Clinton is elected, that Second Amendment rights could possibly be at risk. And not sure how to deal with that. And then he kind of said, without finishing his sentence, something to the effect of those Second Amendment folks could handle it. A lot of people have interpreted that to mean a lot of different things. But can you, off the top of your head, and I know I'm putting you on the spot here, is there anything in presidential history that might rise to the level of this kind of comment that is making the media just go completely berserk today?
Well, we have lots of examples of things that make the media go berserk because that's their job.
Yeah, true.
But you know what does come to mind? This whole story reminds me of Andrew Jackson, who is known as the duelingest president in history. And interestingly, served in Congress with people he had fought with and even dueled with. And, you know, it was just a very different time. I have to say, and I always try to stay apolitical. I don't think it's anyone's, you know, I'm not a political pundit. I'm a storyteller and a guy who looks at through history for interesting stories. Who I vote for is my opinion. But I have to tell you, having read about a lot of presidents and presidential campaigns, I think the real danger in what happened following what Donald Trump said is that, first of all, what he said was so open-ended that you could make a million different interpretations of it. And I think people coming to the conclusion that he was suggesting that they assassinate Hillary Clinton only makes his supporters feel confirmed that the media is out to get him.
Right. Well, it certainly was something that has kept the media wheel running. He gave them a lot of fodder.
When I saw the headline yesterday, and I have to say, I mean, again, I'm keeping my politics to myself, but I saw the headline about him suggesting that someone assassinate Hillary Clinton. And then when I saw what he actually said, I could not have been more disappointed, in a sense, in that I was expecting him to say something like, someone should assassinate her. It's not. He never used the word assassinate. He never used the word shoot. He said, well, those something along the lines of, well, those Second Amendment people, they might be able to take care of it. My interpretation, well, without the aid of a lot of political pundits, would have been lobby and get votes.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot of ways that that could be interpreted. Unfortunately, the reflex tends to send people one way and you know, he left it out there, so people are certainly...
He's also a master at creating exactly this kind of controversy. So,
you think?
Mr. Trump, you have once again brilliantly done the thing you do so brilliantly.
Well, Greg, thanks for spending a few minutes with us here, and I'm sure that, unfortunately, I guess you'll be immersed in this a lot longer than you want to be, but we appreciate your being willing to talk about short-term rentals and... the goings on in the city of Raleigh, and I'm sure that you'll keep us posted if there's anything that does emerge as a development, whether it's positive or negative. And thank you so much for your time and for your work, the books that you've written, and we look forward to talking to you again real soon.
I look forward to it. It's great to be here, Mark.
Thank you very much. Greg Stebbin, folks, and this issue of short-term rentals is just, to me, it's just dumb. You own a piece of property. I mean, yeah, I was talking to my family about this last night or the other night. My son immediately said, well, you know, people have places at the beach and they rent them out. Yes, people own property and they rent it out. It's private property. It's your property. Rent out a room. Oh, well, we got to come in. We got to legislate this. We got to have this ordinance and that ordinance. We got to, you know, make sure you can't do this. And in Austin, you know, you can't have more than six people standing around outside at any one time. And after 10 o'clock, you can't have any non-sleeping activity going on in the house. So what in the world? Who are these people coming up with these ordinances? I mean, really? These are elected officials. They assume by nature of the fact that they were smart enough and had enough ambition and drive to go out and get elected, that they had some kind of measure of intelligence. Now, maybe that's an assumption that we need to re-examine. But folks in Austin, sitting around big conference table with nice padded leather chairs and big pitcher of cold ice water in the middle. And somebody says, oh, you know what I think would be a great idea? Let's pass an ordinance that you can't have more than six people outside. Oh, man, awesome. What a tremendous idea. Oh, well, I can do you one better. After 10 o'clock, can't have any sign of non-sleeping activity in the dwelling. Oh, nirvana. Municipal ordinance nirvana. And somebody was there with a legal pad and a pen, and they wrote it all down very quickly so they wouldn't forget it. And somebody else translated it onto their tablet, and they sent an email to the whoever's taking minutes of the meeting. Make sure you get this right. No non-sleeping activity after 10 o'clock. No more than 6 people allowed outside at any one time. And we will pass these ordinances, and we will go down in Austin, Texas, as one of the dumbest city councils on the planet. Oh, we got to do it. And they did it. And see, what happens when these types of things happen is that money is wasted. It's not like, you know, good legislation like voter ID and House Bill 2 that has to be litigated because of leftist activists. But these kind of ordinances are just dumb and a waste of time and taxpayer money. Anyway, Freedom Action Network is where you're at. This is What Matters in North Carolina. Thanks for listening. Coming up, Dr. Michael Bitzer, great friend of the program, talking about the voter profiles in North Carolina. We'll be right back.
Brady. Supporters holding signs that say Trump digs coal as the Republican nominee pledges to bring back mining jobs.
I mean, you know, it's if I get in, this is what it is, okay? And other forms of energy, all forms of energy.
He's in Virginia, home of Clinton's running mate, also saying moments ago she's running fraudulent ads against him with Wall Street money.
It's really a shame that they can say whatever they want to say. They try and demean and defame.
Trump also says Second Amendment rights must be protected, briefly alluding to a new controversy over gun rights comments. But Hillary Clinton pouncing on it.
Yesterday, we witnessed the latest in a long line of casual comments from Donald Trump that cross the line.
This time, casually inciting violence, as she put it moments ago in Iowa.
Every single one of these incidents shows us that Donald Trump simply does not have the temperament to be president and commander-in-chief of the United States.
Trump insists he meant voting, not violence, in remarks about what Second Amendment supporters could do if they don't want Clinton to be the one picking Supreme Court justices. Police in Arkansas are set to hold a news conference at this hour on the shooting of two officers earlier today. The suspect barricading himself in a house. He was arrested after a standoff more than 4 hours later. One officer had superficial wounds. Police haven't confirmed the condition of a wounded sheriff's deputy, originally reported to be in critical condition. Wall Street at the closing bell. Stocks finished lower. The Dow down 36 points. You're listening to Fox News Radio. Fair and balanced.
Hey, it's Flint Lockwood here from Swallow Falls. My friends and I have just discovered these amazing living foodimals. But wait, we've also discovered a crisis that needs our help. According to my calculations, 1 in 5 kids in America struggles with hunger. That's almost 17 million kids. Our mission is to help solve hunger by teaming up with the Feeding America Network to get food to kids facing hunger in communities across the country.
Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks, helping connect children and families who face hunger to billions of pounds of food, reaching shelters, schools, and community centers in every county in America, including yours. Help Flint and the Feeding America network of food banks get food to the people who need it in your community. Find your local Feeding America food bank at feedingamerica.org/hunger.
Together, we're Feeding America.
A message from Feeding America and the Ad Council.
Whistleblower website WikiLeaks now among those offering a reward for information about the murder of a Democratic Party employee.
Police here in D.C. say they have no witnesses and so far few leads in last month's murder of 27-year-old Seth Rich. WikiLeaks is now offering a $20,000 reward in hopes of learning more information.
I'm suggesting that our sources take risks and they become concerned to see things occurring like that.
WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange in that Dutch TV interview stopped short of saying Rich was a WikiLeaks source. The Democratic National Committee employee was shot and killed walking down the street early in the morning. D.C. police think the motive may have been a robbery and say there's no evidence the victim's employment was connected to the murder. In Washington, Jared Halpern, Fox News.
The serial killer known as the Grim Sleeper is sentenced to death in California.
You're full of evil. You're a Satan representative.
Anitra Washington, the only known survivor of a two-decade killing spree. Lonnie Franklin Jr., convicted of murdering 9 women and 1 girl, suspected of killing more.
It's obvious that you have a deep-seated hatred for women that started long ago.
Judge Kathleen Kennedy, who just before sentencing rejected a defense motion to set the death penalty aside as unconstitutional in California, the defense is seeking a new trial. A document released by a state agency says all of the rides at a Kansas City, Kansas water park passed private inspections in June, including the water slide where a 10-year-old boy was killed over the weekend. Kansas law requires permanent rides to be inspected annually by their parks, and the state randomly audits the records. Again, stocks finished lower on a day when oil prices dropped below $42 a barrel. Lisa Brady, Fox News Radio.
Welcome back to What Matters in North Carolina. Hi there. My name is Mark Shiver. Having a phenomenal Wednesday. If you've missed any of the show up to this point, please make sure you go to freedomactionnetwork.com, download the show as a podcast, or you can find us in the iTunes and Google Play stores as well. We talked with Representative John Blust, Baron Soka, president and founder of Tech Freedom, talking about what's going on with internet and possibly foreign countries having more influence over the technical system that ties together the domain name system, which sounds conspiratorial on the surface, but it's really really real, and it's a fascinating topic. So we appreciate him breaking that down for us. Greg Stebbin, author of 10 books, including White House Confidential, the little book of weird presidential history, talking about not that, but short-term rentals here in Raleigh, North Carolina, and what the city council is talking about doing there, which is a fascinating subject, really, because you just on the surface would assume that people can rent their houses out or rooms in their houses if they own the property. But anyway, that is not the case. And always, 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 always a tremendous pleasure to talk with Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of politics and history at Catawba College. And we're going to talk about his piece called Analysis of the North Carolina Voter Pool. Dr. Bitzer, welcome back.
It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Well, as soon as I saw this, I said, well, I got to talk to him about it because this is fascinating stuff. And I'm not really a numbers guy. I'm glad that you have taken the time to break this out and that there are a lot of nice colors here because that helps me understand. But first of all, without getting into the details, with a broad brush, what can you say about the weekly data file that the North Carolina Board of Elections that you wrote about in this piece as of July 30th,
right,
about the overall North Carolina registered voter pool?
Well, we're actually ahead of where we were 4 years ago at the same time period. 4 years ago in the last presidential election in 2012, we were about 6.4 million registered voters. Right now, we're standing at about 6.6 million registered voters. That's actually in the neighborhood of where we ended up in November of 2012. So we should expect maybe another 200, maybe 300,000 North Carolinians registered to vote between this point and November. And that, you know, kind of defines who is going to be eligible to show up to vote. Now, with the recent Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals decision reinstating same-day registration and provisional voting along with other aspects, that could certainly play an impact there as well. But I'm somebody who does study the numbers, who likes the data and likes to crunch the numbers and kind of see where there are patterns that are emerging. And what we're tending to see is some continuation of what we've seen over time, but certainly the pool is growing. And if we estimate that maybe 65 to 70% of these registered voters are going to show up, we could potentially exceed the 4.5 million ballots cast 4 years ago in 2012 if this is indeed a competitive battleground kind of an election.
I was going to ask you, we have so many registered voters, and yet the percentage of turnout typically is, you know, something that people always scratch their head about and say,
sure,
why don't more people vote? I mean, what this is kind of a probably a question that is maybe you can't really answer, but why do people go to all the trouble in registering and then something as important as voting, they just stay home? I don't get it.
It is a quandary of American politics, to say the least, that people would go through the, you know, it's not a laborious process to register to vote. I mean, you can do it at DMVs, you can do it at different sites, certainly, but it is part of our process. We want voter registration. Now, in some countries around the world, if you don't cast your ballot, you are fined for not voting. So that's a stipulation and a incentive that we have chosen not to do. But yeah, I mean, when it comes to people who have registered to vote, who are, you know, eligible to cast their voice at the ballot box, for folks who study this kind of thing, it does kind of scratch your head, but there is no forced requirement, shall we say, to cast a ballot.
Well, exactly, and certainly we enjoy the greatest freedom in the world here with the right to vote, and mm-hmm. people can avail themselves of that privilege and right or not, history has time and time again shown that a lot of people don't. But nevertheless, breaking down the numbers, it would seem at first glance to me that the state still leans somewhat Democratic, although unaffiliated is on the rise.
Yeah. If you just look at the pure numbers, it would appear that way. In the 6.6 million registered voters, about 40% of them are registered Democrats, 30% of them are registered Republicans, and 29% registered unaffiliated, with about 1% Libertarian. And just in looking at that number, you would say, well, registered Democrats, 10 points better than registered Republicans, this should be a Democratic state. But you have to think one step beyond that. And the key step to think about is a generation of voters here in North Carolina, most likely native North Carolinians, whose daddy was registered a Democrat, and his granddaddy was registered a Democrat, and his great-granddaddy was registered Democrat. And so he's a Democrat, too, except when it gets to casting the ballot, and he turns out to be a Republican. And that's the traditional kind of Southern conservative Democrats, probably more in the rural counties than necessarily in the urban counties. And that kind of legacy is part of the silent generation, those folks born before 1945, and probably a large portion of the baby boomers born between 1945 and 1965. So I think that there is can be some misreading of those numbers, but it is certainly, if you look at the performance of statewide elections, Tom Tillis won with a little over 1% of the vote in terms of a margin of victory. Mitt Romney won with barely 2% margin of victory. Barack Obama in 2008 won by 14,000 votes. So it is a competitive battleground state.
Absolutely. Now, our guest, Dr. Michael Bitzer of Catawba College, professor of politics and history, and certainly recognized as one of the leading voices in North Carolina when it comes to all things history and politics and breaking down voting trends. What's interesting to me is that the state has voted, with several exceptions, but you could pretty well say that they've gone Republican rather often. But then folks get in that ballot box and or that voting booth, and they check oftentimes Democrats for their county commission, for their or even for the council of state. I mean, until recently, it was overwhelmingly Democrats. So there's a disconnect here, it would seem, between people, particularly Democrats, saying, OK, I don't really like the national platform, but when it comes to my state, I'm still going to, you know, keep voting Democrat.
I think that that was very much the case here in North Carolina for a very long time, probably through the 1970s, particularly into the 1980s, with kind of this phenomenon of what we called Reagan Democrats, particularly here in the South. But I think the we're starting to see that lessening of what we call the split ticket voter. If you look at the races, I think in general, they're starting to mirror themselves more and more. Now, working your way down the ballot, you get into the dynamics of local elections, and that's a whole nother story in comparison to statewide races. I think races like the gubernatorial race, the U.S. Senate race, a lot of that is going to be impacted by the top of the ticket, the presidential race, the council of state races probably as well. But you get into local politics, and that's really where the dynamics tend to change because of more intense personalities, more local kind of relationships that are developed. So I think that there is some of that still. You know, I'm going to bounce around the ballot. Maybe there is still some of the voters, but I'm sensing that more and more people are kind of locked into their party affiliation, their party identification, and how that translates in terms of casting their ballots.
Dr. Bitzer, in terms of the polling, I think you and I have discussed this in the past. It's sort of been all over the place. Trump got his post-convention bounce, and then so did Hillary Clinton. And then all of a sudden, it looked like there was this huge polling discrepancy between Hillary and the Donald, where she had opened up in some cases a 13 to 15 point margin of lead. And I saw the other day a service that kind of tries to smooth out polling bias, and it had this race pretty much neck and neck. So with the people in the state here, some polls are showing Trump ahead, some are showing Hillary. How do we, can't you just say, well, there's X number of Democrats and X percent Republicans, and it's going to pretty much turn that way?
Oh, if it was only that easy, it would make my job a whole lot more sane, I would say. I think this is where the public opinion polls, you know, are snapshots in time. And so for any 3-day period, this certain subset that, you know, typically and statistically could mirror a larger population, that's what we kind of focus on in this horse race mentality. I would certainly encourage your listeners to think about looking at websites like Real Clear Politics that takes an average, a moving average of all the polls. One poll may be biased one way, one poll may be slightly biased another way, but kind of smoothing it out, I think that's a more accurate reflection of what is happening at that moment. The thing that you have to remember is for all campaigns, while polling is wonderful, it's about the ground game.
Yeah.
And it's about getting to your voters, getting to your reliable voters, getting them to show up, and then moving on to the next one. And so there is a real scientific method to modern day ground game operations that changed North Carolina from a 13-point George W. Bush victory in 2004 to Barack Obama winning by 14,000 votes. I mean, it is literally, you can go in, you can focus on your base, you can focus on your areas, Democrats in urban areas, Republicans in rural areas. The suburbs are kind of mixed, but they lean more Republican necessarily. But when you have 54% of all registered voters in North Carolina living in urban counties, that tells you where the power lies in this state, and there, Democrats, registered Democrats, tend to outnumber registered Republicans, and registered unaffiliateds, as you mentioned earlier, are the fastest growing group among all of these, particularly when you look within the generations.
Yeah, well, you just took my next question right away from me, because I was looking at that very thing, 54% of registered voters in urban counties.
Mm-hmm.
The unaffiliateds are, as you said, growing rapidly in this state. Is there any way to gauge, is there enough data to gauge yet how they are going to, in other words, with any kind of degree of certainty to predict how they're going to vote?
Well, we know from the research done in political science, and particularly the research done on exit polls and other factors, that in the United States as a whole, but also reflective in North Carolina, those who identify as politically independent or unaffiliated are the fastest growing group in our society. The issue is, when you ask them how do they lean to one party over the other, the vast majority of them will pick one party, and then you ask the question, well, how did you vote in terms of that leaning? And they tend to vote just as if a partisan self-identifier voted for the party as well. So I made a presentation yesterday, and I showed the a graph that I commonly use, and it had independent Democrats voting for Barack Obama in 2012 91% of the time. Independent-leaning Republican-leaning independents voted for Mitt Romney 91% of the time. So I asked the question, are these folks really independents? And, you know, I made the joke that they're basically faux independents, that they don't really subscribe to a kind of battleground or competitive range. And they are a vast majority within that independent brand. And nationally, pure independents are about 15% of the electorate. And that number will shrink as we get closer to November. So it's the partisans who show up. It's the partisans who cast their ballots. And really, it's fighting over smaller slice of the electorate when it comes to those pure independents.
Our guest, Dr. Michael Bitzer, professor of politics and history at Catawba College, one of the leading voices of understanding political trends and voter behavior in North Carolina. And the question, I guess, that stands out hearing you talk about unaffiliated voters is that these are a lot of people who are unregistering their affiliation from a party, correct?
Correct. Or choosing not to register with a party.
Okay. So yeah. if that were the case, that would be new registrants, which, am I correct in assuming that's a lot of younger people?
Yes. I do an analysis and break it down by generations. And if you consider this new generation of what we call millennials, those under the age of 35, those folks are indeed by far deciding to go as a registered unaffiliated. Typically at the statewide, and I just had the numbers up here, they are going to be looking at about 39 to almost 40% of those folks registering unaffiliated. Statewide, it's only 29%. So the danger mark that I see in this new generation is on the Republican side, only a quarter are registering Republican, whereas the state is about 30%. So that's going to be a fascinating trend to kind of see how that plays out among this new generation that should, by November, be an equal percentage in the registration pool as are baby boomers.
So, Dr. Bitzer, in terms of motivation, I'm sort of wandering off the trail here, so I apologize.
That's all right.
In terms of motivation, what would make someone say, I'm no longer a Republican, I'm no longer a Democrat, I am an unaffiliated, I am an independent? Is it more displeasure with the national party platform or is politics in general, just sick of the whole thing?
I could see both of those. I could potentially see a third option play out, and that is, while I'm partisan in heart, I don't necessarily want the label that the parties have taken on. Huh. Both parties have moved certainly and become much more unified in their ideological perspective. The Republican Party is the party of conservatives. That is, without a doubt. The Democrats have moved much more to the left this year, not quite as far left as Republicans have moved towards the conservative side, if you look at any study. But still, the parties are kind of sorting themselves. And what I think we're seeing is folks kind of in the middle say, I don't want to be associated with a party that has moved to the extreme wings. And so they're saying, I'm just going to vote, I'm going to register unaffiliated or independent, but I'm actually going to vote for that particular party. Maybe it's the labeling. Maybe it's the sense of, I have to acknowledge who and what I am. Now, for a strong partisan, they'll be glad to say, yes, I am a registered Republican, or yes, by God, I'm a registered Democrat, and be happy with that. But I think that there is that middle, that kind of look at both parties, particularly this year, and go, I'm not real sure I want to be associated with either one of them.
Huh. Well, this is fascinating, the mindset and the motivations that people will have. I think, and I don't have any data to support this, but I think there may have been a big surge. I know there was in my life and my family, and we grew up as good old, as you called earlier, Southern Democrats. And between 80 and 84, there was a big shift. I mean, you would have never heard Republicans mentioned in my family or where I grew up. And suddenly, it was common to say, well, the party, the Democratic Party left us. And so is a similar thing now is what we're happening? Or has this been happening all along? We're just seeing it more now.
I think you point to a critical time period in American history, and that is 1980 to 1984. I think a lot of people look at Reagan's first election and say, that seems to be when the country really shifted. But for Southern politics, an area that I'm really interested in, I argue that it's 1984 by confirming to those lifelong Southern conservative Democrats that, lo and behold, it's okay to be called a Republican and to identify and to support actively. And so in the South and in North Carolina, which when you look at the national numbers in particularly, you see 1984, which is kind of the high water mark or the beginning point of the country dividing into thirds. A third of us Republicans, a third of us Democrats, and a third of us Independents. And before that, Democrats were kind of seeing their numbers drop. But man, when 1984 hits and Reagan's reelection and basically confirms the Solid South is now Republican Solid South at that time, that's when the trend lines really speak to me in terms of seeing how that happened.
Wow. Well, Dr. Bitzer, as always, I wish we had more time, and I appreciate the time that you have spent with us. I will direct people to your website, oldnorthstatepolitics.com,
sure,
and the analysis of North Carolina's registered voter pool as of July 30th. And by the way, love your Twitter handle, at Bowtie Politics, and very creative and apropos. And So,
and I'll be doing the voter analysis at the beginning of each month, September and October, as we get closer to November's general election.
Well, that sounds very good. Oh, I meant to ask you. So, real quick, 30 mm-hmm. seconds. What's going on in the governor's race? Is McCrory in trouble? Is he okay? What's up?
I think it's like the presidential race. It's going to be tied. It's going to be a coin toss down to the finish line. I really do think once we get into September, the general campaign, all those races at the top of the ticket are probably going to be battleground status.
And we have lots of commercials to look forward to. Dr. Bitzer, thank you as always for joining us here on What Matters in North Carolina.
My pleasure.
All right, folks, I've taken you right up to the end. Got a few seconds to remind you that you can go to freedomactionnetwork.com and download the show as a podcast if you missed any of today's excellent, excellent content. And also, you can find us in the iTunes and Google Play stores as well. How are we going to top today? We are going to blow it up tomorrow. You don't want to miss tomorrow's show. My name is Mark Shiver. You're listening to What Matters in North Carolina. Thanks to our producer, Matt Calder. And we will see you tomorrow. Bye.